This week on the show, with the Patriots done and championship in hand, are the Bruins the best team going in Boston sports? The Red Sox getting ready to lay claim to that task. They've all met down in Fort Myers, and basketball continues to bring the drama out of the All-Star break. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome to the Calling It podcast, recording the afternoon of Thursday, February 21st. My name is Alex Barth, joined each and every week by Alex Lebowitz. Lebowitz, on this snowy Thursday, hello to you.
Hello to you as well. Although it's warming up, I think the snow will be gone, which is nice. So
we're still waiting on that big one. Knock on wood. Still waiting on that.
I know. Well, Punxsutawney Phil came out, and whichever the good one is, being scared of a shadow or not being scared, it was
we
whichever
did not
one
get
the good
six
one.
More weeks of winter, right?
Yeah, it's a short winter, even though that stuff's kind of BS. But hey, I'll take it. And I think the biggest thing is that daylight savings in like 2 or 3 weeks.
Ooh,
so we'll have that extra hour of daylight.
And it always sneaks up on me. And speaking of Punxsutawney Phil, my brother actually – so he goes to school in Western Pennsylvania. He goes to the University of Pittsburgh. He went to Groundhog Day this year.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, it's insane. Like, show up at like 10 p.m. because they pull the groundhog at like 5 in the morning. So people show up at like 10 p.m. and just start drinking all through the night. People like set up tents. They're out in the woods in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. That sounds like a pretty good time.
Well, it's funny how people will make any excuse to drink alcohol. There's a groundhog. We got to drink.
Right, but not only drink, but at like 5 in the morning on a Tuesday in February, outdoors.
Of course. Dude, 1 o'clock kickoffs. You're there at 7 o'clock boozing.
That's at least a weekend, though.
That's true. That is true.
It's not just a groundhog.
Well, but let's be honest. You're in, what is it, central Pennsylvania or somewhere in Pennsylvania,
Western
right?
Western
Pennsylvania, even worse. So what else is there to do besides drink and stare at groundhogs?
That's true.
I mean, that's a way of life.
All right. Well, one other thing they do well in Western Pennsylvania is hockey. Although right now, the hockey world really focusing on Boston. The Bruins have put it together despite some major injuries. David Pastrnak stumbled to an Uber, hurt his thumb. Patrice Bergeron missed some time recently. We all know what the defensive core has been. But the Bruins, 7 in a row, 9-0-1 in their last 10, third best record in hockey. They trail only the Lightning in the Eastern Conference and their own division. I know you didn't get to watch the game last night because you have to go to bed for your show. Did you get to see the highlights, read a recap, any of that?
Oh, yeah, of course. I saw, you know, Jake DeBrus scoring in regulation and scoring the shootout goal, along with David Backes. So, yeah, I've been watching the highlights. I've been trying to read up on these games. The West Coast trips kill me. Fortunately, they're in St. Louis, so it'll be a day game on Saturday. I'll be able to catch that one. But nonetheless, even just reading up on these games, watching highlights, it's hard not to be impressed, especially given the fact that I believe like 5 of these games on this streak have been won without David Pastrnak, as you mentioned.
Yeah. And you mentioned the St. Louis game. They've won 11 in a row. So a lot of eyes going to be on that game on Saturday. But, you know, just sticking to the Bruins, this is one of those years, and it happens, you could say, when the groundhog sees his shadow, that the Bruins always seem to be built on a couple of what-ifs, right? There's something that isn't necessarily going to happen, but the Bruins are counting on certain things breaking their way. And even with all of the injuries, you could say things have broken their way this year. They've gotten enough of an impact from the kids. You mentioned the hot streak that Jake DeBrusk is on right now. Danton Heinen's been a nice piece. Charlie McAvoy's come up big late in games. Not Ryan Donato, who we all thought it was going to be. He's out, but the kids are stepping up well. That top line, even through injuries, they haven't been together much. They've only played in 45 of 61 games together, but Bergeron, Pastrnak, and Marchand all over a point a game right now. Marchand is probably going to break his career high in points with 21 games to go. He needs 14 points to tie it, 15 points to break it. And then the goalies. And you can't say enough about the goalies. They've split them evenly, which, do you remember, I forget if it was last year or 2 years ago, I was calling for this. Part of the problem with Tuukka Rask is he plays so many games, he gets worn out in the playoffs. As we sit here today on Thursday, Rask has played in 33 games, Halak's played in 31, and they've both been excellent. So right now, the biggest question for me with the goalies is when you get to the playoffs, are you going to continue to alternate them? Are you going to go with just Rask? But, I mean, Halak last night, he was outstanding.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have. I think the one big thing with their goaltending is they both become more consistent. We saw Rask stumble in the beginning of the season, at least not play to his capabilities, and Halak was really good. And then it kind of flipped, and they, you know, Rask was playing well, then Halak took a step back. Now they're both playing consistently good hockey, and they're keeping their team in the game. And we have a shootout performance, 31 save night, just like last night with Halak. That's big. So, you know, my gut tells me, and this isn't, far-fetched, they're going to go with Rask when it comes to the postseason. That said, a lot can change between now and then. But he's your guy. And I think the biggest thing that you alluded to is the fact that he isn't playing as many games. It's pretty much a 50-50 split right now. And that's a huge advantage for the Bees.
And part of the problem with the Bruins the last couple of years, and we've heard people say this time and time again, is they've really had five players to fill their top six. Obviously, Marchand, Pasternak, Bergeron, and then Krejci. And there's always seems to be a top six wing with him. Right now, it's Jake DeBrusk. But filling that opposite side next to David Krejci has been a problem. They go out, they trade for Charlie Coyle, the BU kid from Weymouth. And, I mean, he is a top six kind of guy. Now, we thought that about Rick Nash in the past. We've thought that about guys in the past who haven't come in and paid off. But they didn't go out and get Nash or a Ginla or some corpse of a guy who was great 10 years ago. Here's a guy that is still young, is playing at a high level, and it's a different approach from the front office, I feel like, at the deadline this year than we saw in the past. I'm interested to see how that's going to turn out.
Yeah, I mean, if this was the front office of the past, David Pastrnak would be traded after injuring himself going into or coming out of an Uber. So it's nice to see that they're kind of sticking with their core, not trading too many pieces away. And they have confidence in the guys they have right now. I mean, the defense has, you know, has left something to you know, be desired. But still, you talk about these top six guys, those forwards, and they've been playing exceptionally. And the fact that they're playing so well, again, without Pastrnak, and you have him coming back maybe within the next couple weeks, although we still need an update on that injury, it's huge. And with the Celtics being as horrible as they are, it's great to have a team in Boston that's playing at the level as the Bruins are. I think we're overdue.
And we'll get to the Celtics stuff later in the show, so make sure you listen all the way through. But it's interesting you mentioned that maybe it's just to us, obviously to the people who follow the Bruins close and the Celtics, that's not happening quietly, but because of everything that's going on around the Celtics, it feels like this run has happened kind of quietly with the Bruins, the 7 in a row, the 9-0-1 in their last 10. And that may be a good thing, because generally when the Bruins are playing well, they get the majority of the attention, and it's now starting to swing that way. There was a report last week that the Celtics television ratings are in a free fall right now. Not that they're playing head-to-head as much as they were earlier in the year, but the Bruins are going to start to get this attention now. I genuinely believe that. I think the Celtics are going to hit a tipping point where they're going to get not unwatchable, but I think people are fed up with what this team is at this point.
Well, and I think the biggest difference between these two teams, besides the fact that one's exceeding expectations and one team isn't meeting them, is, you know, the Bruins are likable. They got a lot of likable guys on this team, a lot of young guys.
To be fair, some of it's the difference in the sport where basketball is more open. You know more about what's going on outside of the action, where outside of behind the B, you know, do we know that much about the Bruins' personalities? Like, there's not, it's just, I don't know. It's not the nature of the sport where, you know, none of them are sitting down with Rachel Nichols and guaranteeing championships and talking about being on the phone with Sidney Crosby, right? That's just not the nature of the sport. So I don't want to say that they're less likable. I think it's just a different situation. And there is no Kyrie Irving. There is no guy that, you know, is coming in and trying to make this team his. There's a clear, defined leadership on the Bruins. It's the Dano Chara and Patrice Bergeron.
Yeah.
Those guys are in charge. It's well known by everybody inside and outside of that locker room.
Yeah, but that still plays into likability. And that's my main point. It's, you know, for me, and I'm biased, I think the NBA is full of a bunch of divas. And well, I think when you
maybe
have...
Maybe it's just more ingrained in that, you know, Kyrie's only been here, what, a year and a half? Where Chara and Bergeron, and you can throw Marchand in there too, have been here for a decade. So we're just more comfortable with those guys.
Yeah, but I still think there isn't that type of attitude among these guys, even the newer ones who are on this team. And hockey players are a different breed than basketball players. Again, they don't get as much attention. You have a bigger roster, so it's easier to blend in. There's not as much media coverage for the individual or the team. So I guess I get your point. There's not as much of an opportunity to be disliked if you are on a hockey team. But I think just simply given the fact that they are playing as well as they are right now, and they do have those veterans on that team, you know, with the exception of someone like Al Horford, the Celtics don't have that guy. So I don't know. I think it's refreshing to have a team like this to take us through the winter and try to hitch our wagon to.
All right. Well, they're trying to claim a championship. One team's coming back off of a championship, and they will have one less major piece to deal with. We'll talk about that on the other side. This is Calling It, powered by CLNS.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth and Alex Lovitz with you. We're powered by CLNS Media. I butchered that transition. One of my worst of all time. I'll say it. I'll own up to it. Not like anybody on the Celtics would do that.
We'll re-record.
What was that?
We can re-record it.
No. I'll own it. It's fine. Okay. What I meant to say was, obviously, the Red Sox coming off a title, one less piece to deal with. It was supposed to be Manny Machado not being in the AL anymore, but he wasn't in the AL the second half of last year, and the Red Sox actually play the Padres this year. So I'll own it on that. Let's start with Machado before we get into the Red Sox, because I do want to talk about it. He signs the $300 million deal, goes off to baseball obscurity. I don't blame him after embarrassing himself in the playoffs last year. I wouldn't want anybody to find me either. And the Padres now have so much money invested in him and Hosmer, and I know they have a great farm system. I just think that's not an environment for guys who want to compete. There's a reason Bryce Harper isn't there, right? I think Bryce Harper actually cares about winning. You go to San Diego to cash your checks and sit on the beach, and I think this decision validated everything we thought about Manny Machado over the last 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, this is the perfect fit. You're in, Southern California, in a market that, you know, fails sports-wise. You have a beautiful park and a beautiful area, but it's almost too nice to have a hardcore fan base. And that was my experience when I went down there to San Diego. It's all transplants, and I don't think baseball is as ingrained in the culture there, or sports in general, as they are up here. Although you do have a guy like Adam Jones who came out of San Diego, fun fact for you. But yeah, this is the perfect fit for a guy like Manny Machado. He's not someone who I think prioritizes winning. He got his $300 million contract, 10 years security, in a place where he's not going to be ridiculed or criticized all that often. Great deal for him. If I'm the Padres, you had money to blow. And you mentioned it. You have a great farm system that's working its way up, some of which came from Boston. So this seems like a no-brainer for them. The guy, you cannot deny his talent. And if you ask me to pick between him and Bryce Harper, I think from a competitor standpoint, I'd want Harper. But from a talent standpoint, pure talent, I think Machado was the best free agent this offseason. And it's definitely a big get for San Diego.
All right, so the Padres now have essentially $450 million wrapped up over the next 7 years between Eric Hosmer and Manny Machado. How many playoff appearances we see from the Padres during that time span? I'm going to go with like two.
Yeah, I think one or two, maybe. It depends on this farm system and whether or not it comes to fruition and it, you know, guys develop at the rate that people expect them to. But yeah, maybe two, one or two. But so he's just, not going there. He's not going there for winning. And he was there
for $450 million. You hope for some results. And I was talking to somebody about this yesterday, the farm system, the Padres, wonderful farm system. Whoa. The last time they had the top farm system was 2012. And I went back and I read what people like Keith Law were saying about it at the time. And the consensus seemed to be the Padres were set up for a run of 5 to 6 years just based on their farm system. Somebody even said with marginal free agent spending, the Padres are set up to compete for the next half decade or so. They haven't had – not only have they not made the playoffs since 2012, they haven't had a winning record since 2012. And that farm system that everybody drooled over, I mean, there's a couple, you know, decent starters in that, like guys who are plug and play at the bottom of the order. There's really nobody – the only – blue chip prospect they had was Anthony Rizzo, and they traded him for Andrew Cashner. Now, it's a different GM. It's even a different owner. I don't know how it's going to go this time around, but just because you have a farm system, you still got to develop it. It's asset allocation, asset management. Which guys do you keep and develop? Do you develop them correctly? Which guys do you trade? I don't trust the Padres to do that, because are they going to have the money to do it after investing $450 million into these two guys? I put very little stock in a farm system like the Padres, because if history tells us anything, that doesn't mean anything to them. They haven't been able to advance from a successful farm system to a successful major league ball club.
Well, one thing's for sure, at the very least, they have a relatively tight window. And by that, I mean probably 5 or 6 years. Once these guys are big league players, these farm system guys, and maybe if they do actually play up to their standard or up to their expectation, you're going to have to pay them eventually.
Right.
You can take them to arbitration year after year. But as you said, when you have $450 million on the book on the books over the next 7 years, you can only spend so much. But this is kind of an example of how the game's changing. We've seen it with the Astros. They developed a lot of young guys, Altuve, Bregman, yeah. Carlos Correa, and then they bring in other veteran guys like, you know, your Justin Verlanders. And this seems to be the exact model the Padres are going at. I like it. I think it's a worthwhile move. It's just a matter of whether everything comes together and you know, those people you're waiting for, those prospects you're waiting for to develop, whether or not they actually do develop.
Did the Astros never spent that kind of money, though, on free agents, if I remember correctly.
No, so they'll spend that on the guys they have now.
Right, and that to me is a huge difference. All right, let's talk about the Red Sox. They reported to camp on, I want to say, Tuesday. First spring training game is tomorrow. That will be against Northeastern. That's always fun to watch because you see how I think the starter for Northeastern tomorrow is from Billerica. I remember last year the kid was from, I want to say, Dorchester. And his first 25 pitches, 24 were balls. He was just like so in awe of playing the Red Sox. He wouldn't throw inside because do you really want to be the guy if you're like a 20-something-year-old college kid, you're from the Boston area. Let's say you hit Mookie Betts on the hand. Yeah, how are you going home? How are you going home? You can't.
They'd feel so bad. I actually know someone. I went to high school with him. Or no, I used to play. He went to a different high school, actually. But I used to play baseball with him back in the day. Yeah. And he was a Northeastern kid. And okay. He went against, top of the lineup. He got the start. And he actually got Pedroia to swing and miss. Which is on the other side of the spectrum. You don't want to hit the guy, but
right.
You can strike him out. That'd be pretty awesome.
That's something you get to talk about for the rest of your life. So,
But
anyway, so that's coming up. The conversation though around the Red Sox right now, and as it relates to Manny Machado, is okay. Machado got $300 million over 10 years. Harper's probably going to get a little bit more than that. What are we doing with Mookie Betts? The Red Sox continue to take him to arbitration. He continues to be underpaid. But at a certain point, they're going to have to sit down and negotiate a contract. And the longer they wait, the more and more the price is going to go up. And I would not be shocked if you're looking at a near $400 million deal for Mookie Betts at this point. The Red Sox need to act on this. They need to act. He's not a guy. And you had John Henry talk about it, I think it was yesterday, maybe on Tuesday, where he said, we screwed up with John Lester. He admitted it. And you hope that that's not just an admission, but a bit of self-awareness to say, okay, there are certain guys you just don't lowball. Mookie Betts is one of them. The Red Sox kind of need to just hand him a blank check at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the market's set. It's going to be at least, you know, that $30 million annual salary and
right.
Probably at least 8 to 10 years. I would just offer him what Machado was just given. And I'm sick of people saying Betts is overrated. He's not overrated.
He's not. He's better than Machado. I'd rather have him than Machado.
100%.
I believe 100%. He's younger, too.
He's about 2 years younger than Machado, I want to say. And he just has a better attitude. He's someone who plays hard all the way through. You never question the guy's effort. So, yeah, you give him a blank check. I completely agree with you. His contract should set the record. And I think it would be deserving given where the market's at. On the other side of that, though.
By the way, they're both 26. Machado.
They're both the same age. Okay.
Yeah, Betts is a couple of months younger.
And Bogaerts is born in the same week as Betts for what that's for.
Right,
what,
we all know but, that.
So on the other side of the coin, we just saw an offseason in which, you know, Bryce Harper still isn't signed, although it's looking like the Phillies are probably going to get him. And Machado had to wait until, you know, February, what was it, 20th? To get his contract. maybe it is best to wait out to try to see if you can get, you know, sign him for a deal that's fair for both sides or more fair for both sides. That said, is that worth it? I don't think so. I would try to take care of this during the middle of the season before the season ends. Just try to get a figure settled on, because this guy is you know, the future of this team. And this Red Sox ownership loves marketability. Who's more marketable on the Red Sox than Mookie Betts? There's no one. He's the guy. He bowls. He can play basketball. He can run routes. And he's an MVP.
Right. And, you know, to all the people say, well, if you pay Betts, you can't pay Bogarts, you can't pay Bradley. Fine. I think Jackie Bradley Jr. is a trade chip at this year's deadline. Bogarts is good, but if I have to choose between the two, I'm taking Betts every time. Somebody's going to overpay Bogarts. You don't need to be that team, right? Bogarts a Boris guy. I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up in New York, whether it be the Yankees or the Mets. He's going to go chase that big contract. And then there's Chris Sale. And look, would I love to see Chris Sale back? Yes, he's second on my list after Mookie Betts. But the reality is, here you have a guy with what is somewhat of a broken throwing motion. We see the way he throws the ball. Everybody will tell you it's not good on his elbow. It's not good on his shoulder. He's getting up there in age. He hasn't been able to stay healthy. I'd love to keep Chris Sale. He's not the guy I'm investing the future of my franchise in. It's Mookie Betts.
He's also 30 years old.
He's older. And again, like, I don't want to come across like I'm knocking Chris Sale, because he's really he's amazing. I don't know how else to say that, but he's amazing when he's on the field. And we saw what happened the last couple of months of last year. And he had that elbow problem, which really wasn't a surprise given the way he throws. And what do we know about Dombrowski? He has a history of going after pitchers, regardless of what their arm situation is. Thornburg is gone. Who was the other one? Carson Smith is gone.
Thornburg's still there, isn't he?
Oh, he's back in on a minor league deal. Yeah. But
yeah,
They gave up Travis Shaw, right? He's a bust. Chris Sale hasn't gone down that road. And I'm not saying the Chris Sale move was a bad move. I don't want to come across saying that. But Dombrowski's never been one to care about arm durability. How many more innings are you going to get out of Chris Sale versus how many more at-bats, quality at-bats, are you going to get out of Mookie Betts? I think it's clear where that investment needs to go. And then you have Benintendi, too. I didn't mention Benintendi. I would probably put him tied with Chris Sale for second on that list. You'd have to show me the dollar amounts, what it's going to look like to bring back Benintendi and Sale. But again, Betts has to be at the top of that list. He, to me, is a blank check kind of guy.
Absolutely. And I agree with that list. I think Sale and Benintendi are your next two priorities. I might even put Benintendi slightly above Sale for the reasons you mentioned. Durability of Chris Sale. Will he be a guy who lasts into year six of whatever contract he gets? I don't know. That said, I love Sale. I love the edge he brings. And Jackie Bradley Jr., definitely bottom of that list. I think what we're seeing a lot of, though, is people putting too much weight on the playoff performances that we saw in October.
That's what happens.
Yeah, that's what always happens. And Jackie Bradley Jr. played exceptionally in that postseason. You can't overstate that. But still, we saw him during the regular season. We've seen him throughout his entire career. He's hot and cold. There's no consistency with the guy, with the exception of being in center field, being on defense or fielding. With a guy like Mookie Betts, a lot of people are crapping on him because he wasn't as good as he probably should have been in that postseason. He'll come around. The guy's a player, and I think we've seen that firsthand. So I agree with that list. I think Benintendi will probably be the next guy they really want to invest in, with the exception of that of Chris Sale. But I'm also curious to see what Sale asked for. He took a deal that was probably below market value with the White Sox when he signed his last contract, and he's someone who seems like he wouldn't prioritize money. That's just the vibe I get from him. He's a competitor.
And on the flip side, could he be somebody who hasn't prioritized money and now he's trying to get paid? Because I'm in the opposite boat. It's his last big contract. This is his last chance to really get paid.
But he's a psycho.
I think he's going to go all out.
But he's a psycho.
That's true. He is.
So I don't know. I think he'd be miserable on a team like the White Sox again, losing. And I think a lot of it depends on the success of this year's Red Sox team. And, you know, I'm optimistic going into it, even though there isn't a closer.
So you bringing that up is interesting, because I'm just going to cut you off, because where you're going, I think, is the next point I want to bring up. Before we wrap this segment up, the one storyline you're looking for in camp, mine is who the closer is going to be. And it ties into the Chris Sale contract, because the theory some people have is you sign Chris Sale to a 5 or 6 year deal. He's a starter for one or two more years, and then he becomes your closer. So I'm interested to see what they're going to do with the closer. If they can't develop anybody young, I wonder if they just punt the closer decision 2 years down the road and ends up being Chris Sale. Although I have my eyes on Durbin Feltman, the draft pick from last year at a TCU. Mentally, the kid is everything you want in a relief pitcher. He's tough as nails. He doesn't get fazed by the moment. I don't know that he's ready opening day, but I would not be shocked come June or July if he's the setup man and eventually graduates to the closer role. That's my big thing I'm watching in camp.
And that'd be ideal. That'd be awesome if you fill that void. In regard to Sale becoming closer, that comes down to him. If he does not want to be a closer, he won't be a closer. And I think a guy like that loves starting, loves being the first guy to throw the ball off the mound. I don't think he wants to be a guy who finishes it. But if he continues to struggle health-wise with that arm, that's a logical move. And he was effective coming out of the bullpen in the postseason, even though I'm kind of contradicting a point I just made about not putting too much weight on that. He could do it.
A closer to start his career. It's not like he hasn't done it before.
No, he could absolutely do it, but it's like I just think there's a lot of guys who wouldn't want to make that transition. You're making a lot less money. You destroy your market value. And there's some appeal to being that guy who starts game 7 of the World Series or just being the go-to starter on the team. It's definitely on top of the hierarchy of powerful positions to have in baseball. So I could potentially see that. Maybe I think they're going to try to look for more of a long-term solution and they're going to want to keep a guy like Chris Sale in that starting rotation. That said, pitch count's huge, and limiting, you know, how much he throws during the regular season is huge so that he can be durable enough come playoff time.
All right, we'll see. We'll talk plenty more Red Sox, obviously, throughout spring training. We got a couple basketball topics we want to hit before we close the show here. This is Callin' It, powered by CLNS.
Callin' It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Callin' It. Alex Barth and Alex Leibowitz with you on a Thursday. Thursday? No, you got to work tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I mean, I could do Thirsty Thursday. Just be
maybe you'd have to start like right now.
Yeah, and then I'd be in bed by 5. Whew. Actually, that doesn't sound too bad.
All right, well, we know what Alex Leibowitz is doing after the show. We got to talk some Celtics, even though they haven't played since our last show, I believe. Because we did the show Thursday last week, right?
Yeah, and there's the All-Star hiatus.
All-Star break. So, by the way, dunk contest is awful. It like Hamidou Diallo, that was the best, and it was a good dunk. It was, but that was the first real dunk contest dunk that got me excited in like 5 years. Used to be one of my favorite events. It sucks now.
Well, yeah, no one's doing it anymore. Back when it was Nate Robinson and you know, Dwight Howard, Vince Carter, and all, you know, back in the 90s and 80s when actual high caliber players participated, it was a lot of fun to watch. These days, they're just not doing it. And why would you? You risk injury. You risk embarrassment. I understand it. I think the NBA All-Star Weekend is vastly overrated.
It's definitely. How about John Collins with that plane? Like, that was the most unnecessary thing. I mean, me and my friend were laughing our asses off on the couch watching that. He didn't even need a dunk, honestly. If he just brought that plane out, those guys in the hats and left, that would have been entertaining enough. But the reason we have to talk about the Celtics, even though they haven't played, is the All-Star game gave Kyrie Irving plenty of time to do what Kyrie Irving does, and that's be very indecisive about his future in Boston. From a video clip where he may have said to Kevin Durant something about 2 max slots because we're reading lips now, to once again trashing on the young kids on the Celtics. It's really just a mess, and you said it to me before we came on the air. Like, when's the last time that a Boston athlete took this much scrutiny? It's really reminding me a lot of what we went through with David Price. The difference being that Kyrie Irving has a lot more influence over the Celtics than David Price did on the Red Sox.
Not only that, beyond leadership, he's just way more important to the Celtics than David Price is to the Red Sox in regard to, you know, ability and how big of a part he is to, you know, the game day in and day out. It's apples and oranges to an extent, but if that guy is not stable, if he's not, you know, your rock mentally and emotionally speaking, you're kind of screwed. It starts with him, and he has been probably the most ineffective leader I've seen in my lifetime in Boston.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mess. And I feel like there's a daily seesaw with, oh, he's coming back, he's not coming back, he's coming back, he's not coming back. How much of this do you think is real, and how much of this do you think is just, you know, he's playing it up. He enjoys the attention, he enjoys the drama, and he knows what he's going to do, and he's just having some fun with it.
No, I think the indecision is very real. I don't think he knows what he's going to do, or maybe he has an idea of what he wants to do, but whatever that idea is, it's not set on being or staying in Boston. Because if he was set on staying in Boston, he would have said that. We heard it in the beginning of the season.
He did say it. Remember, all the way back in October on opening night, I'm re-signing here, and we had that guarantee. It was all but a certainty, and now certainty it is anything but.
Yeah, and he's gone back on that, and now you have the Danny Ainge comments. It's an engagement, which is a very fancy way of saying
Rocky engagement. This is a Kardashian-esque engagement.
Yes, this is 90-day fiance engagement.
Yeah,
but it's another way of saying we don't know. We do not know, and we're not super confident in the fact that he will stay. And that's the NBA. I mean, you worry about the offseason in the middle of the regular season. It's entertaining. But so many different things could happen for the Celtics within the next 6 months. It's very difficult to predict. One thing's for sure, the way Kyrie Irving has handled his role in Boston and handled the speculation and the media coverage, it's been just super unprofessional. And he's done a disservice to his teammates, I think. Not that he's the only one. You have Tatum guaranteeing a championship. You have Jaylen Brown saying he'll win five by the time he's 28. These guys are getting ahead of themselves. And I think there's a lot of selfishness and just people not keeping things in perspective, you know, on the Celtics.
And again, to go back to the David Price comparison, I think at this point it's title or bust for him if he wants to redeem himself in this city, because he certainly does still have his supporters in the Green Teamers. And I'm not saying that the team is better without him, because that's not true. That's the whole reason that what blows my mind is the people that say, you know, oh, no, they're not better without Kyrie. They need Kyrie. But then they're like, oh, he's staying. I'm not worried about it. Or I'm not worried about if he stays or goes. Like, you got to pick either they're better with him and you're worried about him leaving, or you're not worried about him leaving and they're not better with him. They are better with him. It's an issue if he leaves. That's what it is. It's just a fact. And to me, at this point, the only way he's going to win over the fan base he's lost, and I think at this point, more against him than for him, he's got to pull David Price. He doesn't – Kyrie Irving, as much as he thinks he holds all the cards, does not hold all the cards right now. Because if he leaves, remember what it was like when Ray Allen left. This is going to be 10 times that. Because Ray Allen left at the end of his career, and we kind of knew the title window was over anyway. This is a guy leaving in his prime. And if he stays, they have to win a title, because odds are he's driven players away, and we'll see what happens this offseason, but odds are he's driven a couple of quality players away. If he goes through all this, drives talent away and stays, he has to not win a title, carry them to a title, or all of their faults are going to be put on what he's done over the last 3 months.
Absolutely. And you know, that's the reality. There's a long way left on the season, and come postseason, if he kicks into high gear and starts going off and puts the team on his back, a lot can be forgiven, and a lot would be forgiven, not only among the fans, but among those teammates that, you know, he may have driven away or he might drive away. So, you know, there's a lot of time left to try to figure this out, but it's the uncertainty that's so difficult to deal with from a fan's perspective, from a, you know, a front office perspective, and from a teammate's perspective. The reality is, though, he has to stay. You want him to stay, because he's part of the puzzle. He's a piece of the puzzle, and he's one of the most talented guys. He is the puzzle, yeah, and he's one of the most talented guys in the NBA. You need to bring someone else in, whether that's in Anthony Davis, or whether it's a, you know, Kevin Durant potentially. He needs to stay. If he leaves, that's a squandered opportunity from Danny Ainge. I'm not saying that it's entirely his fault, but it's a squandered opportunity nonetheless. And I just think that'd be bad news for the Celtics. That'd pretty much be this rebuilding process will have been for nothing. To an extent.
You're going back to square one, and you're doing it with a very young Jason Tatum. And we've already been through this with Paul Pierce. Don't spend Jason Tatum's whole career rebuilding like you did with Paul Pierce, because you wasted an all-time great career. And sure, he got a title at the end, but how many more could he have had if he had a little more support early on? One more basketball story. We got to talk about it. UNC Duke. one of the most expensive college basketball games to ever attend. Barack Obama was there. Like, all of the hype, all based around Zion Williamson, and he leaves 30 seconds into the game. Now, we believe it's a knee strain. The team hasn't made an official comment yet. But on the play, too, he blows out his shoe, his Nike shoe. Who is this the worst case scenario for? Is it was Nike the biggest loser last night? Was it Zion? Was it Duke? Was it the NCAA? Was it the idiots who paid $5,000 a ticket? I mean, you could really attack that from any number of directions, because I would go Nike. Their product blows up on national television, the biggest game being worn by the biggest player. I think they're going to have some trouble now signing Zion once he declares for the draft, which should be tomorrow. He should not play another game he doesn't get paid for. And now they're discounting those shoes on their website this morning. Nike is discounting the model of shoes Zion was wearing last night. So to me, the biggest loser is Nike. Obviously, the NCAA is up there too, because once again, here comes the discussion. How much money did Duke and the NCAA make last night on ticket sales, on marketing, on all of that? Zion didn't get a dime, and, you know, knock on wood, he looks to be okay, but falls a slightly different way. Maybe his career is over.
I think the two biggest losers are Duke and the NCAA, because one, I agree with you. If I were Zion Williamson, do not play one more game in the NBA. The fact that it's a mile or the NCAA, yeah, rather, the fact that it's a mile knee sprain means that it's not going to affect your draft stock. You're going to be the number one pick, barring another catastrophic injury. Make sure that is not a possibility. Do not play another game. Make your millions once you get drafted, and do what's best for you and your career. The NCAA is another loser, because this is, you know, sparking the conversation again of players' rights and whether or not they should be able to make money, specifically off their likeness, especially when you're selling $5,000 tickets to see these kids play. Those are the two things. And you know, in the next CBA, I had a conversation with friend of the show, Sam Cooperman, earlier on Twitter.
Yeah,
they're going to make sure that high school athletes can go right to the NBA.
Oh, I was about to bring that up. Good point.
So my question is, why not make it like the NHL? Or to an extent, you can have until you're 22, 23 to enter the draft. You don't have to be 18. But if a team drafts you, have them keep your rights. You can still go to college, but you have that guaranteed money once you graduate. That is, if you were a first round pick. And you're able to develop at a rate that's good for you. But those are the two biggest losers, Duke and the NCAA. The answer for Zion Williamson is, you know, it's easy. Don't play. Yeah, and if he plays again, he's a sucker. I'm sorry.
He shouldn't play another minute. The thing I'd say about the one and done rule, and yeah, I think this is going to be, you know, evidence A when they go to debate that topic, is this is why you need to let these kids in, because in the past, the players didn't really care about these kids in high school because they didn't want to lose jobs. But the NBA Players Association has become such a tight-knit group now. And you saw the way guys were supporting Zion last night on Twitter. Now, will that follow up when there's possible money involved? We will see. But I think the one-and-done rule is gone. For me, the answer is kind of a modified version of what the NFL does, with a little bit of what the MLB does, is you – guys have to play at least 2 years of college basketball unless they come out right after high school. So you can either enter the draft out of high school, or if you go to college, you have to play 2 years and you can enter the draft again. So one or the other. And then the MLB actually has this, which the NCAA is not a fan of, which leads me to believe it's a good idea. Players, they can't sign agents out of high school, but they can basically hire somebody who is essentially an agent that will basically go to teams,
a consultant,
facilitate workouts, right, figure out what the draft stock, what the draft probabilities are, and then go back to that player and say, okay, you know, if you come out now, you're looking at maybe being a fifth round pick, whereas if you go and play in college for a couple of years, you're probably going to be a first or second round pick, and let players weigh that decision. I think that's what the NBA needs to do. Is yes, you can come out of high school. If you go to college, you have to play 2 years, because that helps sells it to the NCAA. It's ultimately better for player development. You're going to end up with better players playing in the league, and you get rid of that one and done rule where the guys who should be coming out of high school don't have to go through this stupid process of playing a meaningless year of college basketball. So Both options work. Anything's better than the system in place right now.
And also, it's a bigger issue with the NCAA, because it still doesn't address them getting paid while they're playing for these schools that are making millions of dollars off of their labor, essentially. Players should be able to make money off of their likeness, plain and simple. that, I mean, the fact that that is, you know, against the rules in the NCAA.
Look, nobody's saying they need to make millions. Just pay them like any other campus employee.
And if they wanted to hold an event or do a meet and greet, do a signing and get paid for doing that signing, doing appearances and whatnot, let them. They should be able to do that.
Mostly, and I want to close it on this because this is the most important part of the whole discussion. Bart, you will not convince me otherwise. If those players, if EA Sports wants to build a video game with the likeness of those players, they can do it. Because damn, do I miss NCAA football and NCAA basketball.
And and EA Sports, people forget, EA Sports was willing to pay these athletes.
Yeah.
It was the NCAA that said nope. Because the reality is, it'd be a slippery slope. You're setting precedent from a legal standpoint, from a logistical standpoint. I get it if you're the NCAA, because, I mean, it is a money-making game. We live in a capitalist society. But right now, you know, when you are making money at the expense of others, and when, you know, you have someone like Zion Williamson who's losing out on millions potentially, although obviously he has an insurance policy, that it's inexcusable to not let these players make what they're worth. They are legal adults. They are making you money. Give them a cut of the action. I'm not saying, you know, D3 Ithaca Bombers football players should be making money. They shouldn't.
That's ridiculous. You're going to get some heat for that.
Oh, God. I'm not saying that. They shouldn't get paid. That'd be a joke. But if you play for Duke.
That's where it gets. Why is a Duke basketball player worth more than, say, a Division III gymnast? And I know
Title
why,
IX, right?
I know why, but why? You get into the Title IX stuff and all you go down a slope, and that's why it's not so easy to just say pay college athletes.
Well, here's the thing. Don't pay them a wage. Pay them for however much they make you. So if you're selling their jerseys, you can put their name on it now.
Then then you're going to look at 10 schools who dominate in every sport, because, like, the fact of the matter is, if you're getting paid based on how much you make the school, if you're a basketball player, you make the school more money at Duke than you do at, say, UMass Lowell. That's just the nature of it. So obviously they're not competing for recruits, but you really start to pull smaller schools out of the equation. In football, you're making the school more in the SEC than you are by – say, going to the CUSA. And the argument those schools have right now is, oh, come to those smaller school, you'll get more playing time, you'll be showcased more, you can improve your draft stock, and it helps keep things balanced. Once you throw money into the equation like that, you remove all of that balance, because guys are going to say, why do I need to improve my draft stock when I can make more money right now?
That's a good point. You probably would have less parity.
You're going to have a lot less parity. You're going to end up being women's basketball in UConn.
That's true.
You're going to have that in every sport.
And that's probably what the NCAA doesn't want to happen. So
they just don't want to have to give up any money they don't have to give up.
That too. But I mean,
if lack of parity made them money, they would go for lack of parity. I believe that. If making college sports as boring as possible somehow increased their bottom line, the NCAA would make college sports as boring as possible.
Of course. There is a way, and I'm sure there are proposals out there. I'm going to start reading up on this stuff. That would be fair for the athletes, and it would not change the dynamic of college sports in general. But I just think if you want to, you know, have a meet and greet, and there's a business or a restaurant or whatever that wants to pay for you to appear there, even a nightclub, who cares? You should be able to do that. And the fact that you can't even create a YouTube channel and you know, financially capitalize off of it without having the NCAA down your throat and being suspended, it's inexcusable. It's disgusting. So there is a balance, obviously. But what they're doing now is just not fair for these athletes.
All right, that'll do it for us this week. Good college sports talk. I know you're normally not a college sports guy, so well done. Golf clap to you. We will be back next week with Red Sox, with Bruins, with Celtics. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Not really. Still far off from the Masters. We got some time before March Madness, so pretty. Who knows what will happen? Maybe Machado signs with the Yankees. Not Machado. Harper signs with the Yankees. We'll see. But will Philly. It just happened, or?
That would be so
happen at the end of the show.
Well, this was about an hour ago coming out of Philly.com, so you know it's legitimate. The Phillies ramping up negotiations with Bryce Harper, and the Mets Syndergaard is apparently not interested in extending with the Mets. So those are the two big stories.
There we go. News breaking at the end of a pre-recorded show. As always, we'll be back next week with all of that and more. You can follow us on Twitter for more shows and content at Callin' It Podcast and check us out online at clnsmedia.com. For Alex Lovitz, I'm Alex Barth. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.